Hello and welcome to FinTech Bytes, a podcast series from CMS, in which we will discuss and provide insight into some of the latest technology and regulatory developments, market trends, and issues affecting FinTech and innovation in financial services.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the CMS FinTech Bytes podcast series. My name is Yasmin Johal and I am a lawyer in the Financial Services Regulatory Team at CMS London, and I'm also a member of the CMS FinTech Practice Group. Today I am joined by my co-host, Dilvir Kang, who is also a member of the Financial Services Regulatory Team at CMS and the CMS FinTech Practice Group. And we're also joined today by a very special guest, Alan Ainsworth. Alan is the head of policy at the OBIE, which is the body that has been leading the development of open banking in the UK. Prior to joining the OBIE, Alan was head of government affairs at Paysafe Group. And prior to that, he spent over 20 years at Barclays Bank across various payment, corporate affairs and government relation roles. So in today's podcast, we will be exploring open banking. Dilvir and I are very excited to be exploring this topic with you, Alan, given that you are one of, you know, the leading experts in this space. Open banking is a term that many of our listeners would have heard of, and perhaps they're operating in this space or looking to move into this field. So I think it's definitely something we all need to be tuned into. So in this podcast, I think we're going to focus on kind of three key areas. Firstly, we'll look at open banking in the UK and what the OBIE has done and is continuing to do in this space. Secondly, we will explore some of the worldwide approaches to open banking and how this compares to the UK's approach. And finally, we'll touch on the emergence of open finance and open data and what this means. So great, let's get started with the fundamentals. Alan, what is open banking and how does this differ to the OBIE?
Thanks for having me on, Yasmin, and great to speak to your listeners. Open banking is two things. So firstly, it's a secure way to allow customers, consumers and small businesses to share their banking data with regulated providers and therefore benefit from a wide range of innovative products and services. The second thing it does is it's opened up the market to new payments providers, enabling them to initiate payments from a bank account without having to share card numbers or remember passwords. In terms of what it does and why open banking is important is that it puts the power back into the hands of the customer, back into the hands of the individual. And essentially, it was designed to rebalance the market in favor of the end user, the customer or the small business. So more competition, more innovation, and more convenience for customers. But I guess more crucially, it gives customers that power to be in control of their finances and engage with their finances in a way that perhaps they haven't been able to do in the past.
That's a really helpful introduction. Thanks for that. What is the OBIE?
The Open Banking Implementation Entity was created by the Competition Authority, the Competition and Markets Authority, following an investigation into retail bank competition. And so we were set up to essentially ensure, one, that a standard was created that nine banks had to implement, and two, to ensure that it's implemented well. Now, I think what's really important is there's a bit of a so what factor in there. Now, the idea was to say, if you can do that, you're allowing customers to share their data with other regulated providers and get the benefits of more choice, more competition, from those new innovative services. And I think what's interesting about that approach is instead of a competition authority looking at a market and classically saying, well, let's make a big provider of two small providers or three small providers or hive off an element of that big provider's portfolio, it said, no, what we'll try to do, very novel in its approach, is find a new way of improving the range of competition, the range of choice available to end users.
Thanks for the summary there, Alan. Sounds absolutely great. And actually, you know, I guess from a kind of a regulatory perspective, there are also differences in, you know, how open banking has emerged and the regulated landscape. Dil, I know this is something that you're into. You know, what is the difference between open banking and PSD2?
So PSD2 is the regulatory layer. PSD2 is some EU legislation that came in a few years ago. And what it does is it sets out how all payment service providers are regulated, the way in which it was implemented in the UK, its implementing legislation does. But what PSD2 also did is it also created a framework for open banking, and open banking is implemented through PSD2. So if you really want to know how open banking works, you need to look at what the OBIE are doing. And what the OBIE did was they created a standard, the open banking standard, which is four APIs that deliver account access. So by having these standards, what the OBIE have done is made it easier for third parties to connect to one another. The open banking standard can be used by an account provider like a bank to comply with the PSD2 requirements, which is the overlaying regulatory requirements.
Thanks, Jill. And actually, Alan, you know, I think there's probably around, you know, 2 million users of open banking. Why is that significant?
I think it's significant for a number of reasons. Firstly, it demonstrates that open banking is a reality in the UK. It has been successful in the UK in a reasonably and relatively short period of time, getting individuals and businesses to sign up for new products and services in a different way to the way they perhaps have done in the past. And I think 2 million is a big number. What it also says is, because the number that we talked about in January was 1 million, but there's a momentum here. It's not just about 2 million. It's about the fact that we have lots of people engaged with on a regular basis with open banking enabled products and services. And there's momentum. Doubling of the numbers in, I'll call it 6 months, because it's 6 months plus a crisis period when there was a lot of people kind of thinking about what to do next. So in just over 6 months, a doubling of numbers suggests not only have we got success, we've got increasing amounts of success. And I'm confident as we see the rest of 2020 come through and into 2021, that new providers will come into play, possibly focused on payments, which will end up with even more end users using open banking-enabled products and services. So I think that's a really positive number that says this has been successful, but also it says it's continuing to be even more successful. So I'm really confident that over the course of the next year or two, we'll see even more people using open banking and, more importantly, benefiting from what open banking can give them.
That's really exciting, Alan. And I imagine, you know, the disruption that's been caused by COVID-19 has definitely, you know, led to many individuals and businesses trying to benefit from open banking, like you said. So this is very, very exciting. So what impact has the OBI seen in open banking, and what differences has it actually made in terms of innovation? Could you maybe explore that in a bit more detail?
Absolutely. So we look at open banking in terms of the types of propositions that customers can benefit from. And I think there's probably 5 categories that I'd use, and I'll give you some examples. So the most obvious one is to help individuals and businesses manage their decision-making, their financial decision-making better. So typically there will be products and services that aggregate people's finances, so across multiple providers. I indeed have got one of these apps where I can see all of my bank account details in one place, and that enables me to say, I can't pay for that particular thing from that bank account. Maybe I should move some money between accounts. And increasingly, you're seeing that payments functionality being added to those accounts as well. And some of these apps also help you understand your finances better and give you ideas and nudges and you can work out which of those providers works best for you. So that's improved financial decision-making. The second one is around borrowing. Now, there's a number of ways in which open banking can help you borrow. One, they can be apps that help direct individuals to new products and find the best product for them. Others are new lenders in the market that can perhaps address issues of access to credit and provide alternatives to bank lending, but indeed other bank lending to individuals and to businesses. So better borrowing. But within that, because open banking is about sharing transaction data with third parties, there's a number of third parties that provide services, sometimes actually back to the bank, to help them with credit decisioning, etc. So instead of credit scoring being something that works in the background, whereby banks share the data, not necessarily with the customer's consent, with credit reference agencies, this is the customer deciding who they want to share their bank data with, but then those providers providing services to banks and lenders to help them with their credit risk decisioning. The third area is around saving and investing. So if you think about it, there's a number of one of the things that I've learned in my experience in banking is that developing a savings habit can be really helpful at encouraging people to save more and get a savings nest egg to deal with situations like perhaps we've had over the last few months. And there are some apps that help the customer save small amounts every month and therefore get into that habit of regularly saving money. Others will look to ensure that customers know where good savings deals are so they can more easily move money from one account to another to get the benefit of the better rate of interest on that savings account. So savings and investing. The fourth one I want to talk about is increased payments choice. Now, as I said before, the 2 million that we've been talking about is primarily what we call account information. So where people are sharing their data rather than benefiting necessarily from new payment methods. We see for the rest of this year and into next year that payments initiation will be a real focus. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means, for example, that I could initiate a payment to, I'll give you a real live example because HMRC have recently announced a tender for payment initiation services. So imagine, instead of being faced with a tax bill, going onto your bank website, mobile or internet, and having to input a code or a reference number, which you inevitably could easily get wrong, but sometimes can take some time to pick, the payment is sent to you by HMRC and you simply have to initiate that. All the reference information is pre-completed. The benefit of that to HMRC or indeed any other potential payee is that reconciliation is 100% accurate. One of the biggest problems with payments is payments that go to the wrong place. So payment initiation can help with reconciliation, but what it can also do is enable account-to-account payment. So at the moment, generally speaking, if I want to pay for something online, I can use bespoke payment providers or I can use cards. This enables you to pay from your bank account for things. And again, a very recent example is that I made a charity donation through one of the well-known charity donation apps, and that went through account-to-account. I didn't have to provide anyone with my card details. I didn't have to sign up with anything new. I simply made a payment from my current account directly into that charity. That reduces the cost of the charity, but also means that I can pay that immediately from my bank account and not have to go through the card process. And of course, more generally speaking, I think the fifth category here is just better customer engagement. How do we ensure that customers are actively engaged with their finances and making the best decisions? And one example of that could be comparing different types of accounts. How do I know I'm getting the best deal that I possibly can? And indeed, some providers are saying to their customers, how about while you're with us, and it could be a challenger bank, they could also extract information about their other banks, their existing bank account information, and then maybe suggest to them that perhaps if they move more of their business across from one organization to another, the customers could benefit from better deals and even say this is exactly the amount in pounds and pence, the benefit to you as an individual customer. So there's a lot more engagement. So I think there's far more examples that I could give you, but that's just five proposition types that I can think of. But the benefit of open banking is it's not down to us to decide what those propositions are or to give you the headings of what those propositions are. It's for the market to develop propositions, to test them live in market and see if customers want them and benefit from them. And there's so many different examples that I could come up with. We're going to talk hopefully about the Nestor Open Up Challenge in a second, where you've got a great deal of innovation in market of areas which I haven't covered already, where customers can truly benefit from the opportunities of open banking in the marketplace.
Alan, thank you. That was a very useful insight into, you know, the various propositions. And, you know, there seems to be a lot going on in terms of innovation and how this is stemming into the financial services industry and open banking specifically. And, you know, you mentioned the Nestor Challenge, and it's something I would really like to hear more about. I know the OBIE has been very supportive and they've backed the Nestor Challenge and Open Up 2020 in order to, you know, help identify fintechs and support them as they bring new open banking propositions to the market. So can you tell us a bit more about that, Alan, and maybe explore some of the things that you've been seeing?
Yeah, what's really interesting is that this has been funded by the big banks. So I think, you know, credit to the big banks for saying that they would fund the Open Up Challenge. We're talking about a 1.5 million prize fund to the best ideas of innovative ways to provide services to consumer-facing businesses. We had a really good Nesta challenge at the beginning of the open banking process, which was focused on small businesses and services that could be offered to small businesses. That was so successful that the CMA 9, the banks that fund the OBIE, decided they wanted to move forward and do something for consumer-facing businesses. We've got 15 finalists. They've all been awarded with £50,000. Some, three of those, have been awarded £100,000 because of their focus on financial inclusion. And so what's great is to see the way in which these organisations approach different problems. One of the problems that kind of leapt out at me was, what if you've got people in vulnerable circumstances who perhaps need some help? Now, historically, power of attorneys have been a bit of a blunt instrument around enabling somebody else, a carer or somebody that can look after that vulnerable customer, to have a level of control over their financial situation. But what about if you simply want to ensure that somebody, a carer, for example, or a parent, or even someone involved in family, could see things about someone's account that could trigger a question of, hang on a minute, are they making sensible decisions here? Do I need to intervene in that person's life and into their finances? And maybe just make sure that they're doing the right thing and they haven't been, for example, swindled or just making a decision that perhaps is not the right decision for them. So that's just one example, which I think is clever and innovative, because it triggers an alert to the carer to say, hang on, there's a question here. It doesn't tell you what to do. It just says, hang on, there's a question here, because the system is looking at a pattern of financial transactions and saying, hang on, there's something here which is out of sync, something here that doesn't make sense. That's just one example. There are others. But what's really interesting is the amount of different ways in which innovative companies can come up with that can help solve real life problems. And that's what the Nesta Challenge is about. And of course, there are other examples of that are happening in the open banking ecosystem that aren't in the Nesta Challenge. Of course, this was about trying to encourage more to come through. But what's really fascinating being involved with open banking is that the range of innovation, the range of different ideas is so significant that it would take me a lot longer than I've got on this podcast to give a full range of examples to you.
It's always interesting to hear about how open banking is helping vulnerable customers. And on a kind of similar note, I was wondering, how has the ecosystem helped both the market and consumers deal with the impact of COVID-19?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Dil. And one of the things that we wanted to make sure we were thinking about when the crisis hit and lots of businesses were facing very difficult situations was, what could we do to help? And we thought there's a number. One of the benefits of open banking is this word, and I've used it before, is ecosystem. We have a network of banks, ASPSPs that we call them, and we have a network of fintechs, of TPPs as we call them in open banking. And that's a great number of organizations that we regularly talk to, we have events with, we communicate with. So we have one of the big things is collaboration in the fintech arena. No doubt you've come across this, that you have banks working with fintechs to deliver services to customers. We collaborate on the development of standards. So all the standards that we put out into market, the open banking standards, have been the result of a lot of consultation, a lot of collaboration. And also, when something is slightly broken, doesn't work with the API, we get involved in helping sort that issue by bringing banks and third parties together. So we said, hang on. One of the big things, one of the really important parts of open banking is this essence of ecosystem, this essence of collaboration. So we said, how about we do something using the power of the network to bring people together to see what the whole ecosystem can do to support consumers and SMEs during the COVID-19 crisis. So we brought people together, and what we did is we got the ideas together and we put those out on a website called the Power of the Network through the openbanking.org.uk website and said, this is what's going on. These are the ideas that are coming through. And that built a momentum up so that if you wanted to look for a way in which an open banking participant could support you as a business or an individual, that website had that list. And what's really interesting is the number of ideas that came through. Now, the obvious ideas are how some of the fintechs can support individuals when they have particular strains on their financial circumstances due to the crisis. Now, of course, there are people in vulnerable situations all the time. But what's happened here is an escalation and a speeding up of finding solutions to some of these issues. What I've always thought, having worked in large banks in the past, is that when people have debt issues and financial problems and they go to a debt charity and say, hey, can you help? For the first 30 or so minutes, the debt charity is taking verbally from that customer, if it's on the telephone or face to face, an income and expenditure output from them and saying, you know, how much you spend on gas, how much you spend on food. If you use open banking, that problem can be solved pretty much immediately by having access to the customer's transaction data from their bank account. So the debt charity can then spend that half an hour or so supporting the customer and helping them through the problem that they've got, rather than simply trying to understand the nature of the problem they've got themselves into. So I think it's really important to understand the range of different ways in which open banking can help people generally, but of course, with the crisis, some of those individual issues have sped up. I mean, I think if we had the crisis again, I think there's a lot of learnings that we've taken on, government have taken on, about how you could leverage open banking to solve some of the bigger issues that have come to the fore during this crisis. For example, how does government ensure that it's providing the support that people are entitled to the right people? And by understanding from a small business perspective the extent to which your small business has been affected by the crisis, you can find out a lot about that from looking at transaction data on the bank statement, which can be accessed through open banking. So there's a number of ways, if there were such a crisis in the future, that government could get involved and start to use that to ensure that they're targeting support to the right people and getting support out there a lot quicker than perhaps it did at the beginning of this particular crisis.
I was wondering whether or not during this crisis, have you seen any new innovations for businesses that have arisen through open banking?
I can't speak to particular innovations that have come for small business. What we've seen, however, is a speeding up of businesses using open banking to get a better understanding of their financial situation. Now, there was a bit of a lag when the crisis first hit. So if I look at the numbers, and we just talked about 2 million, there was a lag immediately following the crisis where people just didn't get engaged within, you know, there were a lot of issues that people were focusing on instead of signing up with open banking services. A lot of organisations seeing how they could adjust to the situation that was caused by the crisis. But following that, what we saw was more and more people saying, how can I use this to support my business, and consumers getting more involved in how they could use open banking. I think the big shift with the crisis, and it's a bigger shift than just open banking, has been a shift to digital. Now, we all know that over the course of this crisis, more and more people have, for example, used e-commerce. More and more people, like you and I at the moment, are talking over cloud-based computing. If it hadn't been for the crisis, I think we'd probably be in a building or a studio somewhere having these conversations. There's been a significant shift to digital. And banks, for example, have seen a significant shift from using branches to using digital channels. That can only help with open banking. As more and more people get used to using digital technology, open banking becomes more normal, more routine, more in line with their normal other banking habits. And I certainly believe that over the course of the next 6 to 12 months, because of this bigger shift to digital, you'll have more and more people comfortable using open banking services.
Thanks everybody for listening. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Anne Nainsworth from Open Banking. If you want any further details around the topic or on any of the points that we've discussed today in this podcast, then please could you contact either myself or Yasmin, and our contact details are linked below. We also frequently publish thought leadership on this area, and you can also visit us at our FinTech webpage or our Twitter webpage, which is also linked below. Thanks for listening and take care.